Blog Talk Radio.
It's the V-Spot. I'm your host, Dr. Vic Tater. My co-host is Bill Foster. V-Spot Radio is brought to you by Planet Vic Tater Blog Network. Get everything you need and a few things you truly do not want. Only at Planet Vic Tater. All right, we're on the air. Today we have legendary Spider-Man writer and a ton of other stuff, Jerry Conway, with us. And, of course, the lovely Neil.
Hello.
All right, Jerry, thank you very much for joining us.
Happy to do it.
Okay, I guess the first thing I want to get into is, how did you start writing comics?
Well, let's see. I lived in New York City, and this was back in the, well, I lived in New York City for most of my life until the late 70s, but in the mid-60s, DC Comics used to do a weekly tour at their offices, and I got my dad to take me down there one summer week, and then I made it a habit to go back, and my initial idea was to try to draw comics. They suggested I try writing them after they saw my art. And I did that. I tried writing some stories for them and eventually sold some stories, and one thing led to another. So I had read about a guy named Jim Shooter who had started writing, I guess, Legion of Superheroes when he was 13 years old, and I was about 13, 14 years old, so I figured he could do it, I could do it. So that kind of pinheaded arrogance did me some good.
Yeah, it's one of those things, you know, it's like until you try doing it yourself, you don't really realize how difficult it is.
That's true. But on the other hand, when you're a teenager, I think you're constantly full of self-confidence if you're not completely full of self-doubt, you know, and you don't really know what is possible and what is impossible. These days, when I think about the kind of energy and arrogance that I exhibited, you know, when I was a teen, I'm like flabbergasted, you know, that I had that much chutzpah. But I did, you know, and I just kept pushing until somebody finally let me in.
I think when you're a kid, it's one of those things that if you really knew what you were up against, none of us would try.
Absolutely. Well, that's why they say that teenagers have no sense of their own mortality. They can't imagine themselves dying, so they take reckless and ridiculous chances. And that's kind of what I did, you know, when you come down to it. I mean, not in a life and death sort of way, but in the sense of not knowing, you know, what was possible. I just assumed that it would be possible if I wanted to do it. I wish I still had that kind of chutzpah.
What was the first comic you sold?
I sold a 3-page mystery / suspense / horror story to an editor named Murray Boltonoff at DC Comics. I spent the summer, I guess I was 16 years old, or the summer I turned 16, writing and rewriting this 3-page story for him. And at the end of the summer, he finally, I guess, got tired and decided to buy it from me. And that led to getting assignments from Vic Giordano, who had actually encouraged me before Murray Boltonoff. And I did a lot of little mystery and suspense stories for House of Secrets and The Witching Hour. And that led to, you know, House of Mystery and The Phantom Stranger, and eventually doing similar kinds of stories for Marvel for their little suspense magazines, Tales of Shadows or something like that.
Yeah, they brought back their horror books.
That's how I broke in at Marvel, and then eventually that led to me getting regular assignments on their superhero books.
When you do those, when you do the mystery books, those type of things, would you come up with the premise yourself, and you know, then get, and pitch it to them, and then they tell you to write a story, or would they just have a list of premises and tell you to do that?
No, I pitch story ideas. I usually would write like a paragraph, which was an outline of the story, and based on that, you know, I would give them like three or four story ideas, and out of those, maybe they'd pick one or two that they would do. Then after a while, instead of having to write it out, I would, you know, talk to the editors because I knew them, you know, and I would just say, I have this idea for a story about X, Y, Z, and they'd say, okay, make it 10 pages, you know, so then I would write that. So it was a kind of, initially it was a formal procedure, and then eventually it became kind of informal as they came to the
question. Do you think that you had more edit freedom just doing these one-shot mystery stories?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you have a much, much better opportunity to come in because there's much less risk for the editors to hiring someone. You know, I mean, if you screw up a 5-6 page story, it's not going to cost them that much to write it off, and they're not risking a scheduling issue. You know, by scheduling a story, you know, an entire issue around you. So it was a good opportunity for a lot of us to break in. I mean, people like Marv Wolfman and Len Wein broke in around the same time in the same way. It was a simpler route, you know, than what people have to do now. I can't imagine how people end up writing comics these days. You know, I mean, you have to basically create yourself through the independents before you get a point where you could get an assignment from a mainstream publisher.
It does seem like now that you either have to do that or you have to be already successful writing in some other form to get a jump on big books.
Yeah. It's sort of the reverse of the path that I took, you know, which was to write comic books, which led to me writing novels, which gave me the experience, you know, to write screenplays, which then turned into a career writing TV. Nowadays, people write TV, then they write screenplays, then they write novels, and then they finally get to write the comic books. So it's completely different, and it's kind of bizarre, but here it is.
Do you think that the lack of that has helped comics? Do you think that this has helped comics, or do you think it's hurt that they don't really have a better – it seems like they don't have a better farm system in place now for writers and artists?
Well, you'd have to judge that for yourself in terms of whether you think that comics today are more creative – and more inventive than they were, say, 20 years ago or 30 years ago. I think it's a different, you know, it's a different field than it was. You know, we were fairly freewheeling at the time that I came in, and there was much less at risk. You know, I mean, from a publisher's point of view, comics today are, you know, multi-billion-dollar potential market. Not the comic book publishing itself, but what it can lead to in terms of feature films and television shows and so on. So they have, I think, much greater sense of risk, you know, to trying out new things. But when I was doing it, you know, they'd give people a crack at projects, you know, that were fairly major. I mean, for newcomers to be involved in. You know, I was writing Spider-Man by the time I was 19 years old, and I'd been in the field for less than 2-3 years at that point.
that's one of those things that makes me feel very small.
Well, it shouldn't, because, you know, the comic book business itself was very small back then. You know, when I started writing for Marvel, Marvel was publishing 10 to 12 titles a month. You know, it was barely as big as Image is today. I mean, it was nothing. I mean, it was number two, and any individual comic book was selling 300,000 to 400,000 copies. but it was not a huge enterprise. The entire Marvel office, you know, could fit into, you know, a 1,200 square foot office space when I was working there, when I first started working there. So, you know, the idea that, that I would come over there, start out by writing Iron Man and Submariner, and then, you know, a year or so, a year and a half later, end up writing their top title, only seems shocking if you don't realize that there's only three of us working there. That's writer. So was it like, you know, I was fighting off a whole slew of other people. It was just me, Roy Thomas, and Stan Lee. You know, and when Stan started to wind down, it was Roy and I, and then a, you know, a couple of other writers pinch hitting here and there, and then eventually it expanded. But
something I was wondering about the Iron Man Submariner one shot. Why did they do that?
How do you mean?
What I mean is, was there a reason they did the Iron Man Submariner book together, like as a one shot title? Was there like a publishing reason for it, or was it like an experiment?
Oh, you mean when they first started publishing Iron Man and Submariner in the back of Iron Man?
There was
a contract that Marvel Comics had with its distributor that they could only publish 10 or 12 titles a month. They were held to a specific number of titles. Oddly enough, their distributor was DC Comics, so you might realize that that was why they were being held to that. So if they wanted to popularize new characters, they had to find ways to introduce them, you know, in already established books. So in the case of Iron Man, you had Iron Man was appearing, I think, in Tales of Suspense. And eventually what they did is they put, you know, Submariner into the back of Iron Man, you know, and did both of them together, or you know, Captain America in the back of Iron Man, and flipped that around, and then Submariner, you know, had his title, and you know, so on. I think it was simply a way to sort of maneuver things from a business point of view, and then finally, when they got a different distributor, that's when in the early 70s Marvel started to erupt with so many new titles and started trying to grab market share away from DC.
Do you think that from a creative standpoint that helped Marvel having so many more books to publish, or do you think having less might have focused them more?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, the big advantage that sudden explosion had is that it, in a weird sort of way, because more crap came out, I mean, let's say a lot of crap came out, it loosened the gates for more creativity. You couldn't, the Marvel editorial system was to have one editor overseeing all of the titles, and they didn't change that system for about 5 years, effectively, after they started expanding. You ended up with a lot of unsupervised talent. Now, unsupervised talent will produce a lot of crap, but it will also produce, you know, some very inventive things. I mean, Steve Gerber could never have done Howard the Duck if he had been heavily supervised by an editor. That just never would have happened, right?
I read a story one time where they said that an editor told him to kill Howard the Duck after he got notice of him, and then he got letters saying bring him back.
Yeah, exactly. But Howard would never have appeared in the first place if there hadn't been, you know, the lack of supervision. And the same is true with a lot of the great work that Steve Englehart did, some of the work that I did. A lot of people were very poorly supervised, which led to, you know, a lot of bad stuff, you know, and a lot of really good stuff. The problem that the comic book business has now, I think, is that the oversight is so intense. You're not going to have that idiosyncratic burst of creativity where somebody can just, you know, do a Howard the Duck. You know, I mean, just blindly because he doesn't know any better. I mean, Steve's attitude towards Man-Thing was that he thought it was, you know, a waste of time for the most part. I mean, he didn't really like the book that much. But he saw the opportunity that it gave him, that because nobody was paying any attention, to just do some absurdist sort of things, you know, to do some radically different and creative things. And that was a really good, for Marvel, it was really good for the business. These days, between the combination of the fact that you've got so much oversight and the fact that the creators know that any ideas they come up with are potentially worth millions of dollars, you have far less opportunity for creators to spontaneously invent new things within the existing universes.
The crossovers now.
Yeah. And that goes in lieu of any new real creativity. You know, I mean, when was the last time a really new X-Man came along? You know? I mean, when was the last time a really new supervillain for the Avengers came along? We used to pump them out every month. Yeah, it was like clockwork. You know, we needed a new villain. Just pop, you know, okay, let's do this. I mean, that's how the Punisher came about. We needed to fill an issue, and since none of us thought that any of this meant anything financially beyond the paycheck that we were getting for that particular story, we felt free to be as inventive as we wanted to be. And we didn't have
If you mind if I fast forward a little bit, because I don't want to forget about this. When you created the Punisher, how did you see the character?
Well, initially I saw him, it went through, I think, a couple of phases. The first phase, when I first came up with the idea of needing that character, it was to fill a story point. I wanted to introduce the Jackal. Who was going to be my new Green Goblin-esque type character, a master manipulator,
right.
the behind the scenes sort of figure. And in order to give him a distance from Spider-Man in their first encounters, I wanted an intermediary character to interact with Spider-Man on the Jackal's behalf. So at that time, vigilantes were, you know, kind of a popular subculture topic. And I thought of, you know, a guy who's kind of a vigilante who gets put onto Spider-Man by the Jackal, thinking that Spider-Man's a bad guy, thinking he's doing a good thing, but, you know, he isn't, would make for an interesting character. But then as I developed into the story, I saw that, you know, this guy has a little more interesting qualities to him. By the time we ended up doing the issue, finishing the issue, we realized we had something that was potentially a bit, you know, a notch or two a bit above the average villain. But to think that we would turn out to be this kind of iconic character, none of us had that in mind. It was a very pleasant surprise, you know, in one sense.
One thing I wanted to ask you is, as the creator of the Punisher, because, you know, I've read a lot of the Punisher comics over the years, because, you know, from, you know, just searching the books out to when I found a bunch of them in the quarter bins or what have you, and it seems like the Punisher is a very difficult character for writers to get right, because some people tend to turn him into a parody of what he is, you know, like with the guns ablazing, and I always got the impression from his early appearances is he didn't really seem that vicious and psychotic about it. It seemed more like he kind of had more of a soldier-like mentality.
Yeah, well, I think if you think of him, in a sense, he's sort of like Batman with guns. He's somebody who believes it that only he can provide justice, you know, punishment, you know, to the bad guys. In his case, that means he wants them dead. You know, Batman takes it one step back, you know, and just wants to bring them to justice, you know, and have the courts deal with them. But the Punisher wants them dead. He believes that that's the way to go. But it's not from a lack of grasp of reality. This is him assessing the situation, like as a soldier, and saying, okay, this is a war. I'm going to go fight this war. But that's just my take. I think one of the great things about the Punisher, like Batman, is that he's a bit of a Rorschach test. And, of course, this this is why Rorschach is also an interesting character, right? Because as a writer, given whatever environment, your cultural milieu you're currently working in, you can turn the Punisher to speak to that milieu. You know, so at the time that I was writing the Punisher initially, we were dealing with the concept of people feeling out of control in their own society, where feeling that they could not be protected. New York was a very dangerous place at that time. It was had a lot of crime. People felt endangered everywhere. You know, it was not a safe place to go walking at night. So while someone like the Punisher is obviously not, in my view, a legitimate response, you know, to that, it is a culturally legitimate response. It speaks to something in the culture that's going on at the moment. Later on, you know, when the culture no longer needs a character like the Punisher in a sense where he doesn't fit, you know, the particular social need, then the writers can find something in him that's slightly different. Then you sort of redefine him as a sign of social psychosis, right? You know, so then now that version of the Punisher becomes the crazy Punisher. And then, you know, as time goes by, you find another interpretation of the character. So it's not so much that there should be only one consistent version of the Punisher. It's that the Punisher is an excellent tool to talk about larger issues. You know,
right, the world around him.
Yeah, it's the kind of stories you want to tell about him. And that reflects your own place, you know, in the society. You know, it's like Captain America. Captain America also is a great character to use to comment on American society.
I always said this idea that the Punisher as a character in his own book, it's not necessarily he would be the focus, it's more how people would react to him.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, exactly. He should be, in a sense, the characters around the Punisher can be much more interesting than the Punisher himself. The Punisher could almost be a blank slate. But again, that's just another take, right? I mean, we can. I at one point was thinking it would be fun to do a series, a Batman series. I was actually going to pitch this, in which the entire Batman storyline, Batman is not in the foreground. It's always going to be about Commissioner Gordon. It's going to be about Alfred. It's going to be about, and Batman is just doing his stuff in the background, and you're going to be following all these people who are interacting with him and seeing how his presence affects them. But, you know, that's just a writing, you know, that's a writer's game, you know, and as from a reader's point of view, that's another valid, you know, interpretation for a particular storyline. I think characters like the Punisher are a lot of fun for writers and for readers because you can literally do almost anything with them. I mean, look at the way they're dealing with them in the Ultimate Universe. I think that's very clever too. So it's fun. I'm very glad to have been part of that.
All right, go back a little bit. How did you get put on Spider-Man? Now you said that it wasn't as big a deal then, but when they were finding your replacement writer for Spider-Man, did they treat it like a big deal, or was it more we have to get donuts all the time?
It was a big deal. I mean, we knew that this was Marvel's flagship title. The only reason that I got the assignment was because Roy Thomas, who was the natural person to follow Stan, really didn't like Spider-Man as a character to write. He preferred team books. You know, he preferred groups. And the solo character just didn't appeal to him that much. In fact, Roy's funny in a lot of ways. I mean, obviously his glamour job for him is to write the Justice Society, you know, rather than or Captain Marvel, you know, something from the 1940s. That would be what he would prefer. But he also has this theory, or he had this theory, that characters should be more like their names. So he wanted, he was the one who suggested to me that when I took over Batman, that I should make Batman a vampire, you know, make him an actual Batman, you know, give him bat wings, you know, and it's like, well, okay, that sounded like fun for a few issues, so I did that. But Roy, you know, when he got Spider-Man to do a Philadelphia Spider-Man, he made Spider-Man a Spider-Man. He gave him six arms or whatever it was. Because that's how he thinks. He's very literal minded. So obviously he was not the guy to do Spider-Man.
Okay, so were you the one that had to wrap up the six arm story?
No, he finished that off. But that was just a fill in for I think three or four issues that he did for Stan. And then Stan came back for a handful of issues and then finally, you know, he just couldn't fit it into his schedule anymore, and handed over that and Fantastic Four to Roy and I. I mean, Roy took over Fantastic Four and I took over Spider-Man.
Did you feel a lot of pressure when you started on Spider-Man?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, Spider-Man, first of all, is my favorite Marvel character. Bar none. I had started reading Spider-Man almost with like the first issue, because I was 19 when I took the book over, so it was Peter's age, for God's sake. it was like writing me, which I've said, you know, in the past. And I was very self-conscious of it, you know, for the first 6 or 8 months, and I worked very closely with John Romita, who was the artist for the first half dozen issues that I did, who helped me a lot to learn how to plot the character and to plot the stories. And I tried very much to write it as I felt Stan would have written it back in the day that you know, he wrote the stories that I most enjoyed.
Pardon me. At what point did you finally feel like that the book belonged to you, in a sense? Like you weren't living in someone else's house anymore.
I think after the Gwen Stacy storyline, the death of Gwen Stacy, because at that point, you know, I my fingerprints were then thoroughly all over the book. That's not to say, because there have been, you know, rumors that I did this while Stan was out of town and all that nonsense. But that was definitely a storyline that we, as a group, came up with. But once I got to writing the romance between Peter and Mary Jane, which was the romance that I actually felt some empathy for, that's when I started feeling that the book was representing my views of the character. And when Peter, you know, got his new apartment, and I started putting into it a lot of my personal experiences that was happening to me at the time, you know, where things that I will say that, you know, obviously I wasn't climbing around on buildings and, you know, like that, but I was having my issues, you know, with friends. I was having my issues with my boss. I was having my issues with my romance, you know, and so a lot of that sort of translated itself into Peter's stories. And by the second year that I was on the book, I was feeling very comfortable with it. And by the third year, I really felt I had hit my stride thoroughly and was very happy with what I was doing. And then I left. So it's like, that was good. It worked well for me.
One thing I really loved my favorite part of it was, because when I read this run a few years ago, is that Peter really seemed like a genuine person in mourning. It was never overwrought where every panel of him was, you know, mourning, but it seemed like, you know, some days he'd have his good days, then he'd have a bad day.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think close to real life, and I mean, you have to move on, you know, you have to live. Plus, Peter had an excellent defense mechanism, which was that wisecracking persona that he could throw on as Spider-Man. So he could submerge some of that grief and focus it, you know, in his activities as Spider-Man, which I had always seen was part of his character. I mean, that's how he dealt with the death of Uncle Ben, you know, and that's how he dealt with his guilt about not always being there for Aunt May. It was always part of his character that he had that dichotomy, you know, between the devil may care sort of jokester mentality that he expressed as Spider-Man, and the more thoughtful, you know, introverted Peter Parker self, which is why, by the way, I found Mary Jane to be a really good foil for him too, because she was such an extrovert that she brought that aspect of Peter out of himself, you know, and it played nicely, you know, against each other.
Now, one thing I wondered about as far as the story when Stacy got killed, to me it seemed like, I was wondering about when the, Norman Osborn was killed, was that intended to be a permanent death, or was that going to be a supervillain death?
No, it was permanent. I mean, back then, this was a period where if a guy didn't fall off a rooftop and disappear from view, if he actually died, they stayed dead. That was back then. Nowadays, you know, people can have bullets through their brain and they'll be back up and around, you know, three issues later. There was and part of that, to my view, is because we don't create as many villains as we used to. In the old days, not to sound like a complete old fart, you know, you could kill off a character and it didn't mean that you were going to be stumped for another great villain, you know, at some point. You knew that you could always create another villain. You didn't kill off characters, you know, that were crucial to the series. And Green Goblin, you have to remember, was not, like, I mean, while we see him today as the epitome of the Spider-Man villain, he wasn't that active in Peter's life.
He didn't appear as often. Dr. Octopus was kind of on a higher rung.
Right. Dr. Octopus was much more prevalent, and even Kingpin for a while was a bigger part of the Spider-Man universe. So it's almost like Green Goblin and Gwen Stacy, both of them, their status in the Marvel universe was raised by their deaths, you know.
Absolutely. You know, I was saying that, I was talking to a friend about Spider-Man. I always said that I think that being dead helped Norman Osborn as a character more than anything, because he wasn't used.
Oh, yeah.
Meanwhile, Dr. Octopus was kind of, he kind of got drugged through the mud at times.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Octopus, because familiarity breeds contempt, right? You know, if you see Dr. Octopus as much as you did over the years, he becomes first of all, he's an absurd character. They were, all of the characters back then, for the most part, you could look at them and say, yeah, it's kind of silly. You know, really look at them. But he, more so than most, you know, was kind of a silly-looking character. But having him recur as frequently as he did, after a while, it became less and less credible. But with Norman Osborn, with Green Goblin, especially the Norman Osborn version of Green Goblin, make him kind of, he could feel kind of iconic because he became legend, you know, like Gwen Stacy became legend. And, you know, in retrospect, legends are always much more impressive than the reality.
Did you already have plans for the Jackal when the Green Goblin was killed off to make sure Spider-Man had another master villain?
Nope. I knew that I was going to have to come up with another master villain, but I didn't necessarily think of the Jackal per se. The Jackal was, and that whole storyline with the Gwen Stacy clone was a response to something that Stan wanted, because he had gotten such grief from people when he went to speak at colleges about Marvel Comics. People were hassling him about Gwen dying. So he thought, let's bring her back. You know, we can do that. But we didn't want to bring her back, and So, you know, after some negotiation, we came up with this notion, you know, of bringing her back but not bringing her back. And then that led to the storyline that introduced the Drackle. But it seems kind of seamless, you know, if you, in an amazing sort of retrofitting way, that we were able to make it work the way that we did. But I kind of knew that we'd have to do something with the Goblin. But remember, I was thinking Harry Osborn would come into play as the Goblin. But I didn't think that he was going to be, you know, that Harry Osborn would ever have the status of Norman Osborn. First of all, he was too young. And his Goblin would always be, you know, a bit less threatening, you know, than...
Oh, like a little boy wearing daddy's shoes.
Yeah. I mean, it was just...
You know, it's like you're not going to... Like, do you ever... It's like I always told my nephew, who's 8 years old, and he was trying to tell me to take it more seriously. I said, Dylan, let me explain something to you. I changed your diapers. I'm never going to see you as anything more than that.
Right, exactly. You know, it's very hard to perceive a young person becoming an adult, you know. I mean, even though, obviously, Harry would have been just as dangerous in a lot of ways... I don't think he had the. I don't think he had the potential leadership status, you know, that the
right.
original Goblin had.
He's more of a wild card.
Right. Right.
One of the things, and let me ask this because I'm sure you've been asked this probably 100 times, but I've seen this debate a bunch of times that. When Gwen fell, some people try to say that that Spider-Man broke her neck by accident with the web line, and that she would have died, that she died from shock. Which was it?
Well, it's open to interpretation. My personal interpretation is that her neck broke.
Okay.
But it is open to interpretation. For those who don't want to think that way, it's perfectly reasonable to think of the other. Although, I've got to tell you, a guy I know who wrote a book called The Physics of Superheroes does say that you know, the fall would not have killed her, and that the whiplash would have, you know, so that would have had to have been it. And I think, honestly, it makes it much more tragic, you know, that and much more realistic, you know, it's the attempt to save her. I mean, the fact is you can't always win, you know, and superheroes can't always win. One of the things I liked about writing television and writing for Law and Order, which I did, was that, you know, we could do stories where the bad guys get off, you know, because that's real life. Now, I don't know that you could necessarily get away with that today, you know, to the way that we did, because that was that anarchy issue that I was talking about earlier. But in a sort of, in a way, the death of Gwen Stacy is kind of an answer to the moral conundrum that Spider-Man was faced with by the death of Uncle Ben, which was he felt responsible for Ben's death because he didn't interfere to stop the killer, right? Well,
right.
Here we have a situation where he tries to stop the death of a loved one, and it still happens. So, you know, sometimes life doesn't allow you to be a hero. And that was, for many people, what they got out of that story, you know, and why it became such a cause celebre was that this was, you know, a hero failing. And that hadn't happened, you know, very, very often in comics. So it was a bit of a shock.
When you were on Spider-Man, you created more than a few villains. Did you have a particular favorite of the original villains you came up with?
You mean in the original group of from the early 70s?
The one your original run on Amazing.
Yeah, I guess I loved the Jackal. Probably was one of my favorites. Certainly the Punisher, obviously. I think, you know, I liked Hammerhead. You know, he was sort of my effort to be a...
Okay, yeah,
creative.
You did help me.
Yeah.
I forget sometimes kind of blink together.
Yeah. But I think out of all the villains that I've created for Spider-Man, my favorite probably is Tombstone. Of all of them.
That was when you were doing Spectacular in the 80s.
Yeah. I liked him because he was kind of a Tracy-type villain, a Dick Tracy-type villain, not too over the top, more threatening in his relentlessness and his amorality than, you know, necessarily any powers that he might have had. So I tend to think that the character of the villain is more interesting necessarily than the powers of the villain, you know, because we can come up with all kinds of powers, you know, for that don't necessarily make, or like, for example, the Vulture has a terrific set of powers, but he's a boring villain. Who cares, right? he's a bald guy. He flies around. The Scorpion is a little more interesting because he's a bit of a blue collar villain. You know, a guy who just wants to knock things down and get money. Sandman's an even more interesting villain because he's really blue collar, really nothing. You know, but this guy who wants the buck. Doc Ock, very interesting because he's a brilliant scientist who has this fallout, this tragic accident. So, I mean, as I say, the powers aren't as impressive to me as the character underlying the powers.
Okay, we only got a few more minutes. I want to get into this quickly if I can. When you came back to do the Spider-Man books in the late 80s, had things changed a lot at Marvel?
Yeah, they had. I mean, for one thing, they had an editorial system that was more structured than had been in place before. There was much less freewheeling independence. Although I have to say that Jim Salicrup, my editor on Spider-Man, was very encouraging of me, you know, doing the kinds of stories I wanted to do, and didn't provide, you know, a lot of soul-crushing oversight. So I didn't experience too much stress, you know, excess supervision. But it had a different atmosphere. I mean, it wasn't, I don't think it was as much of a fun place to be. And that's not to say that a business should be fun, you know, but people, when we were in the early 70s, Marvel was expanding so rapidly and so excitingly, you know. I mean, we were all a bunch of young kids, you know, not very many of us were out of our 20s, just having fun, you know, doing a bunch of different things. By the 90s, late 80s, early 90s, things had become much more serious in the business. The stakes were higher. You know, we knew that these properties potentially had financial benefits beyond publishing. A lot of people's incomes were reliant on royalties. The business itself was kind of going through a rough period in terms of sales. So it was a different atmosphere there.
I'm sorry to say, we only got 2 minutes left. I was wondering, could you possibly stop in next week?
I don't know. I mean, let's play it by ear.
Okay, then. All right, well, thank you very much for joining us. I was hoping to get into more about the clones, but it's one of those things, you've done so much, you know, it's hard to cover everything.
I know. It is tough.
All right, well,
but thank you for the
conversation.
Take care.
No problem. You have a good day.
You too.
And we are out.